Hey, Rory, could you please just tell us a little bit about yourself? Where do you live? Where do you? What's your family setup slash who is in your family? And what do you usually do during the week?
So I'm from Perth. I'm married to Susan. We've got four boys. They're all young, like 7, 6, 2, 4 and 2. And we live, in Perth. And I'm a pastor at a local church near a university.
Cool. And what do you love most about what you do during the week?
There's big coffee kickbacks in my kind of work. Yeah, so, yeah.
Cool. And, we understand that here at Sydney Uni. And how did you become a Christian?
I think my parents were Christians. So I was raised in the Christian faith. So I think probably a slightly better question in my case is, why am I still a Christian? And the answer to that would be really at university in a situation like this, being with a group of people that were willing to grapple with things and ask harder questions than had been asked on the way up. I think that's why I'm still a Christian. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Rory's going to be sharing with us now about the resurrection and the meaning of the empty tomb. If you have any questions about anything that he's going to be talking about, the number to ask questions to will come up on the screen. And after he's spoken for the next half an hour or so, we'll have an opportunity to Rory will have an opportunity to answer some of those questions. But I'll hand over to Rory now. So would you please give him your attention?
Cool. Well, great to be here, and always fun to be in a new city. You know, when you get to a new city, you have that kind of, I experience it as a 48-hour window where everything's fresh. You know, the first 48 hours where you just suddenly, you notice things that you don't see at home, and there's smells that you don't smell at home, and everything kind of looks and feels different. And you've got this 48-hour chance to see the city with fresh eyes before that kind of all recedes and everything starts to feel normal. So I'm from Perth, and I did live in Sydney for 4 years about 10 years ago, and I vividly remember that 48-hour window of my first time in Sydney. I moved here and lived just in Newtown, actually, just quite close to the uni. And the first day I got here, slept at the place I was moved into, and the next day I woke up, didn't know a soul in Sydney. So I just walked across this very campus down to Glebe, randomly bought a bike, no plan to buy one, but just walked out of a shop with a bike, and then just started riding, and I ended up in Redfern. And then in Redfern, I saw a sign that said Bondi. And I thought, okay, we're closer to Bondi than I thought. And so I thought, I've got to follow that sign to Bondi. And I had this kind of magical mystery tour, which only someone who didn't know Sydney would have, where I just kind of rode until the next sign said Bondi and ended up on this kind of random path through Paddington and into the eastern suburbs and so on. And it was really great. And I kept thinking that with all these signs that clearly Bondi is just around the corner, and instead you entered into this kind of, from a Perth perspective, kind of dense urban environment of, you know, Paddington and so on, and it was kind of completely gorgeous and completely great. And then I turned around the corner, and you know, the path I went anyway, there's no warning. You don't see little glimpses of the ocean from miles away. And so I remember just coming up, it was January, it was a warm day, around this corner, and then suddenly, bang, like there's Bondi. And it was just massive and recognizable from television and so on. And like my pupils are dilated and my senses were on hyperdrive. And I totally remember that day. And I was here for 4 years, I only remember a couple of other days of that. But I remember that one because I was fresh and I was just seeing all this stuff for the first time. And I mention that story because over the next 3 days, I want to kind of tell another story. I want to tell the story about the emergence of Christian hope. I want to tell the story of how it is that Christians came to believe a very striking thing about what God is doing in and for this world. And over the next 3 days, I want to talk about that from several different angles. I want to think a bit about the resurrection of Jesus itself, about whether it happened, about what it means for nature and for our bodies, whether it's wish fulfillment or something that a reasonable and rational person could ground their life in, whether it's private or public truth. But today, as we kind of begin that story, I want to begin with another provincial traveller who found himself in a big city for the first time and saw it with fresh eyes. And the person, the traveller, the provincial is Paul, and the city is Athens. Now, Athens is a city whose fame kind of went before it. So Paul, the great early Christian missionary, goes to Athens, but it would have been known to him by reputation. It was the city of Socrates, of Plato, and of Aristotle. Its heyday was several centuries before Plato, but it still kind of basks in the afterglow of its greatness and still existed as one of the great intellectual and cultural centres of the Roman Empire. And you might think that someone like Paul, who's the early Christian missionary, would have good reason to go to Athens on purpose to try to connect with the culture and the intellectual elites, to kind of go upstream so as to influence the rest of the Roman Empire. Because I guess if you could capture the mind of Athens, maybe you could capture the world. But it actually turns out in the story I want to tell you that Paul seems to have gone into Athens without a plan at all. In fact, in Acts 17, where this story comes from, he was in Athens not in order to change the world, but he was just kind of waiting. He had to go to the coast and he was meeting some colleagues, some other missionaries, and they were going to get together in Athens and then launch out. But in that time, in that kind of serendipitous, 48 hours, he's got these fresh eyes on the city and he sees it with new eyes. And in the story, in the book of Acts, in the New Testament, the writer, who's a guy called Luke, explains what happened to Paul when he looked at Athens with fresh eyes. And he said this: while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. Paul, as a new guy to this big, scary city, looks, and the thing that he sees is idols everywhere. And he sees them and they kind of distress him, and he starts wanting to talk to the city, even though he's just there to wait. He starts to want to talk to the city about the idols. And so he goes into the marketplace in this story and he's there talking to people. And frankly, it's not going that well. In the story, when Paul is motivated to speak about the idols, there's a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who begin to debate with him. And the Epicureans are down the kind of materialist end. They kind of believe that the material world is pretty much all there is, and there may be gods, but they're distant and irrelevant. And the Stoics believe in the divine logos, that reason is supreme because it's grounded in the divine reason. And you would think that for these guys, there's all sorts of points of contact that Paul could make with them, and they could have a good conversation and maybe move forward in understanding. But on the contrary, in the story, half of them say, what is this babbler trying to say? That it's kind of a derogatory word and probably has to do with Paul's accent. He's from the provinces and he's Jewish, and they just literally can't understand what he's talking about. And then for the people that could understand him in the busyness of the marketplace, they just keep hearing these two words, Jesus and Anastasis. Jesus, Anastasis. Jesus, Anastasis. And as they listen to him, they conclude he must be advocating foreign gods. Like Orsus has Isis. This must be a male god called Jesus, and there's some female consort called Anastasis, and there are these two new gods that this random provincial is wanting to promote. And of course, that's ironic, because the thing that distresses Paul about Athens is how many gods there are, and it sounds like he's promoting two more. But on the contrary, when Paul is talking about Jesus and Anastasis, he's talking about a man called Jesus and a thing called resurrection. He's talking about a man called Jesus and something called the resurrection. And in this story, things get a bit better for Paul, because people listen to him enough that he gets the invite to Mars Hill. He's invited to kind of come up to the mountain, to the Areopagus, where the intellectuals meet and move together, and he's given a chance to outline and defend his position. And there's a great little note, actually, from the author, because you think to yourself, what kind of city is this, where you're just in a market, and suddenly you've got time to go up and just discuss all day on the Areopagus, ideas and so on, and haven't they got jobs to do and economies to run? And the writer tells you, Luke, that all the Athenians, this is a quote, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. So, kind of a cool town. And he's called up to make this speech. And Paul, you can imagine this is kind of nerve-wracking. He's there on the Areopagus on Mars Hill, and he's Jewish and he's provincial, and he gets to make a speech to the great intellectual heavies. And he kicks off with what I think only fresh eyes would notice about Athens. He says, "Men of Athens, I see that you are very religious." Paul looks at this great city, this city that is famed for its rationalism and its advances in logic and science and so on. And he says, "I see that you're very religious." And I don't think he means it as a compliment. The word he uses actually has the force to it of like superstitious or credulous or almost kind of gullible and overly pious. And Paul looks at this great university town, this center of rational thought and learning, and he says, "You know, I was really surprised to land in your town and find out that for all that, you're actually really religious. This is a very religious town." And then with that, he launches into this great critique of idolatry. Because, you see, for Paul, when he gets his chance to speak, he wants to talk about his belief based in the Jewish scriptures that humans are made for worship. So at one level, I don't think he's not surprised to find worship, because he believes what the Old Testament teaches, which is that humans are made for worship, and that when we suppress our nature to worship, it's like trying to hold a balloon down in a swimming pool. It just keeps finding its way to the surface again. And it finds its way to the surface in Athens, the most rational of towns, in all the worshipping of all the idols. G.K. Chesterton said that when we cease to worship the true and living God, instead of worshipping nothing, we find ourselves worshipping anything. And that's Paul's experience of Athens. It's a very religious town. Because in Athens, they seem to have failed to have got rid of the Creator, but ended up not in no worship, but in broken worship. And the Bible's word for broken worship is idolatry. Idolatry is worship gone wild. There's a famous story in the Old Testament in one of the Jewish prophets called Isaiah, where Isaiah asks a really simple question, which is, you know, when you see people worshipping idols, what's the origins of that idol? Where did that idol come from? And Isaiah tells this famous kind of parody story where he says, well, what happens for an idol is that a guy goes into a forest and he cuts down a tree and the tree falls down, and then he goes at it with an axe, and half of it he burns as a fire, and he cooks on the fire, and he eats from the fire, and he keeps warm, and he says to the fire, "Ah, this is great, I'm keeping warm, I love this." And then with the other half of the same tree, he takes his knife and he fashions a god. And he bows down to the other half of the tree and he says, "Save me, you are my God, and I worship you." And Isaiah says, "Can we back this truck up? Because what the heck? You cut the tree down. You did it. It only exists because of you. Half of it you burnt for wood, and that half of the tree didn't protest and say, 'Don't burn me, I'm actually a god.' And then the other half you carved and you shaped and you formed, and then you bow down to it and say, 'Save me, you are my God.'" And Isaiah, the Old Testament guy, says, it should worship you. All its glory comes from you. You made it, dude. If anything, it should end up in an art gallery with a little sign saying, "Eric made this," so that your friends could say, "Eric, that's awesome. You made that thing." But instead, in broken worship, the works of our hands become things that we bow down to and say to them, "Save me, you are my God." And you see, Paul goes into Athens and he says, "Athens, I'm surprised at you. You're really religious." And you might hear that and think, well, there's an obvious gap here, because Australia isn't like that. That if you came to Sydney and you had fresh eyes, one of the things you're least likely to say is that Sydney is very religious. And maybe it's the case that we have succeeded where the Athenians failed. And maybe we've achieved the great dream of rationalism without religion, and the dream of science without superstition, and the dream of progress without piety. Would anyone look at Sydney and say, "You're really religious"? Well, it kind of depends on how you define idolatry. Because I think at heart, idolatry, broken worship, isn't about religiosity and certain kinds of images and so on. At heart, idol worship is the worship of a thing that is less than you. It's exchanging the worship of the Creator for the worship of elements of creation. Or my little definition, idolatry is when something smaller than you becomes bigger than you. Idolatry, peeled back, is when something smaller than you becomes bigger than you. And I think that happens in every Australian capital, like all the time. Because all the time in Australia, you see people abasing themselves before things that are smaller than them. Their career, their job, their prestige, their status, the things that we will do to have those things. I think you see it in materialism and greed, where people enter into a kind of religious behavior of sacrifice in order to possess things and to cast out other values in order to own and possess and have. You see it in the nation state, you know, flags and songs and people pledging loyalty to a nation and being prepared to die and be killed for a nation. How is that not religious? And you see it in modern relationships, where instead of, you know, broken people coming together and making a go of it, we say to each other, be my God, be my Savior, tell me that I'm significant and secure. Simon and Garfunkel have a fantastic 60s ballad called Kathy's Song. I don't know if you know it. The lyric says this: so you see, I've come to doubt all that I once held as true. I stand alone without belief. The only truth I know is you. And it's a completely gorgeous song. And it's kind of bad news for Kathy. Because here's this guy that stands alone without belief. And he says to her, the only truth I know is you. That is, I'm going to lean all my religious weight on this relationship. And no relationship is made to withstand that kind of weight. In May of 2005, the brilliant American author David Foster Wallace noted the same thing. He, himself not a Christian, Wallace nevertheless commended the practice of worshipping a deity. And his reason was this. He said to the students at Kenyon College, because why should you worship a deity? Because pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if that's where you tap into the real meaning of life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start to show, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Paul goes to Athens and he speaks out against idolatry because it's broken worship. Because you put your weight on something that cannot carry it. And so Paul says to the Athenians, to the great center of rationalism, we shouldn't think of the divine being like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design or skill. And he addresses this overly religious town of Athens, not with atheism, but with God. With a better vision, a bigger vision of God. He says in verse 24, and I quote, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples made by human hands." Paul goes up to Mars Hill and he gives this startling and brilliant vision of God. That he's not just one of the gods. And it's worth, I think, in the climate of new atheism to tease out two things I think are kind of a category error of conflating God with the gods. You hear that a lot, I guess, that people say, oh, well, atheists reject thousands and thousands of gods and Christians reject thousands and thousands of gods, and it's just that Christians hold on to one God, which atheists also reject. And I think that is a category error because the Greeks believed in kind of an eternal universe, it just always was, by and large, and they believed in gods that inhabit this universe. That gods that are kind of bigger and more powerful than us, but still gods that have a beginning, that are born, gods that come into existence. And many of those gods also had an end in store. And they copulate and fight and argue and send thunder and so on. They are part of the inventory of things that exist. That there are coffee tables and mice and stars and gods. But what Paul is talking about is not that. He's talking about the Creator God, who is not part of the inventory of things that exist, but a God who is outside of creation. Not to speak about another being that we all missed, but it's to talk about the ground and source of all being. And I think sometimes atheists speak, and to be fair, Christians give them grounds for speaking like this. Sometimes atheists speak as if we are speaking about God as an inventory of something that is in this world, like an invisible friend that has been detected by Christians but somehow missed by everyone else. And if you only listen hard enough and look hard enough, he's kind of hiding just over there, and he left a little bit of evidence just over here. It's like saying that you have the play Hamlet, and in Hamlet there's Ophelia and Claudius, and there's the ghost of Hamlet's father, and there's Hamlet himself and the grave diggers, and there's all these characters, and Christians are just saying, and there's this other character that you've missed called God, and he's there too, and you should pay attention to him. But God is not another character. He's Shakespeare. God is not another character in the play. He is the author of the play. He stands outside the drama. He is the ground and source of the whole thing. Shakespeare never appears in Hamlet. And yet every jot and tittle of the play are from Shakespeare. They exist by him and for him. And the vision of God that Paul gives in Athens is like that. A God who is outside the world, and also I think it stands to reason, a God who is outside the world and is in control of whether he's known in the world. If Shakespeare decides to not include himself in Hamlet, there's no way any character is going to bump into him by accident. God has to write himself into the play to be known by us. And that is the claim that Paul finishes with on that day in Athens. Because Paul ends this great speech to the Athenians when he talks about idolatry and broken worship and a God that exists outside of the creation and is not part of the inventory of created things. Paul talks about those things and their ideas and their concepts, but Paul ends with a claim that's not metaphysical, but historical. In a speech that's largely about what happened, Paul ends by saying something has happened. Namely, and I quote, that in the past God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. The Athenians love to do nothing but talk about the latest ideas, and Paul's up for that. Let's do it. Let's talk about ideas. But Paul ends with history. He ends with this claim that something has happened, specifically that God will judge the world with justice. That God will one day bring the sad and sorry drama of human suffering to a close, that he will vindicate the oppressed and bring the oppressor to justice, that he will expel sin and evil from the drama, that he will bring comfort to the afflicted and hope to the lost and justice to everyone. Paul says that God is going to do that by the man he has appointed, and he has given proof of this to everyone by raising Jesus from the dead. Over the next few talks, I would love to engage with you on this question. Because Paul says that God has written himself into our drama. That the God who is outside of our existence, who is outside of time and space, has written himself in to history, has provided proof of his coming justice by raising Jesus Christ from the dead. The God who is outside of it all puts himself and his neck on the chopping block of history to promise to a future where justice will come, where sin and suffering and death will be cast out, where there is a future for our bodies, a future for the material world. In the next talk, I want to think about how that lands in the Jewish scriptures. From which scriptures in the Old Testament did Paul and Jesus understand these things? Tomorrow I want to think about the public truth of the death of Jesus. Could you believe it as a rational person? And in the talks that follow, I want to think about what it would look like to live in the light of that being true. What that life would look like. Ask the so what question. love to be able to talk with you about this for as long as you can. Really looking forward to it. Thank you.
We have 5 or 10 minutes now to answer some questions, for Rory to answer some questions about any questions that you guys have. So would you feel free to text any questions that you have through to this number. We might invite Rory back up here. I have a question to start off with. And as I said, feel free to text any questions through. Rory, you mentioned that the resurrection, to some extent, achieves justice. Do you want to elaborate on how that or comes about and what that means?
So Paul says to the Athenians that God will judge the world with justice, and that's standard issue Jewish thought, that history is linear and that it will be, there's a good God that exists in opposition to evil, and the Jewish resolution of that is that God will bring justice one day, will put the world right again. And so that's standard issue Judaism. And then Paul adds, he has appointed a man to do it. And that's kind of the surprise, that through Jesus, claims Paul, and by his resurrection, God has appointed one of us to judge us. So there'll be a human on the throne judging humanity sympathetically and justly.
Great, thank you. There's some more questions coming through on the text line. Okay, excellent. I'll ask some questions that come through, so feel free to text any questions through. Here's another question that's come through. This person says, dead people don't rise, science tells us this. How can Christians claim... Oh, there's a mobile call coming through. How can Christians claim that Jesus rose from the dead? It's a big question, obviously, but if you could do your best to tap into some of that.
Excellent. I will be talking about that in the third talk, so that'll be tomorrow at 12 o'clock. But you share the same problem that the early Christians shared. They wouldn't have called it science, but they certainly were of the opinion that dead bodies don't rise. And we'll see, I think actually in the next talk and then again tomorrow, how they came to believe in something that there was no precedent for, either in their scriptures or in their experience. Can I say, they were as surprised as you were. And I think the answer is the power of God as opposed to any intrinsic value. Christians don't believe in the immortality of the soul. Christians believe in the power of God to raise Jesus from the dead. That's how they understand it.
Yeah. Excellent. Lots of questions coming through. This question reads, if God is the playwright and we are the characters, doesn't that mean that humans don't get to choose what happens in their life, including believing in God, Jesus, and the resurrection?
Great. I think the analogy between Shakespeare and God is inexact, or it serves a purpose. So I'm not saying that we're in this weird and wonderful play where we do have agency and where things happen because we choose to do things and so on. And there's a whole complicated, in my mind at least, complicated relationship between God, the author of life, and us, the responsible agents in life. The analogy falls down at that point.
Another question that's come through, did Jesus ever explicitly say that he is God?
There's a couple of times where in John's Gospel where he uses Old Testament quotes about Yahweh, the technical name for the God of Israel, to apply to himself. So he was certainly understood to be occupying the same space as God. But the idea that the Christian belief is that Jesus is God is true, but in a Trinitarian way, is resolved in the doctrine of the Trinity, not resolved in the doctrine of saying, oh, they're the same person and God was not in heaven because he was on a cross and so on. And in fact, I don't think the resurrection proves that Jesus is God. So again, we'll talk about this tomorrow, but I don't think, well, why would it? Why would you think, someone comes out of the grave, you think, oh, that person must be God. There's like 11 steps that have been missed in that. And in fact, I think the step never gets there. So I think if you're under the impression that Christians believe Jesus rose from the dead, therefore Jesus is God, that's a foreign idea to the Bible.
Excellent. Keep it rolling. Why did Jesus choose not to show himself physically to the world and just to a few followers after his resurrection? So I think this person is talking about, can we really trust the validity of that account?
Yeah, there's a quantity thing there. So Jesus put in a fairly good effort. So he appeared to over 500 people all at once and to people in different places and so on, and appeared to unbelievers. So the problem with encountering Jesus risen from the dead is that you don't stay an unbeliever for very long. So people are like, oh, why did he appear to non-Christians? Well, it's hard to stay a non-Christian when you've met the risen Jesus. So Paul, for example, is off to kill Christians, which is about as not Christian as you can get, and meets Jesus and stuff like that. So I think that you might argue the toss over, I wish he'd appeared to 600 or 800, but I think whatever the quantity is, you're still left at our time in history with witnesses, and we'll have to grapple with that in talk three about the reasonableness or otherwise of trusting witnesses. Yeah.
A couple more questions before we finish up. This question reads, do you think anything has been done in other religions at the same level or greater than the resurrection of Jesus? So lots of religions make fantastic claims. Is there anything that comes close to the resurrection?
Yeah, I think there's things that if they were true would be probably better than, like in terms of the ancient Mesopotamian myths of gods like cutting monsters in half and creating the heavens and the earth. That is just on a sheer kind of Hollywood film level, more visually impacting, right? If you could film a monster being cut in half and half of it being the earth and half of it being the sky, I'd pay $12 to see it. So one of the weird things about the resurrection is that it's event plus meaning that you have to grapple with. So by itself, a man walking out of the tomb still begs a whole lot of questions. Your work is still in front of you in terms of what does that mean? In which vision of the world does that make sense? And I think when you understand not only the credibility that happened, together with the interpretation of what happened, I think then you're cooking with gas, and that's why I'm a Christian. And what that's saying is actually amazing. But I don't want to spoil talk three. Yeah.
And one more question. This person is asking about the significance of the resurrection and what exactly happens after death for a normal person. What does the Bible say about those sorts of things?
Excellent. And that'll be the second talk. So if you're able to hang around, I'm not making this up. It sounds like I'm evasive. But no, the second talk will be about that. Surprisingly, the Bible, I think, has three, or the New Testament has maybe three or four verses that give you any sense of what happens after your immediate death. And it's surprisingly, it's way more interesting to us than it is to the New Testament. Because the New Testament has a couple of things to say about your experience at point of death. It has an awful lot to say about what happens at the resurrection of the dead and in the new creation. And that's really, it puts almost all its chips in that jar. And so the Bible is really about, as one scholar has put it, what happens after life, after death. And that's where we'll be in talk four and five.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Could we thank Rory for sharing with us this hour? Yeah.